By now, you've likely heard that yesterday in Oregon, a 26-year-old man shot and killed 10 students, or 9 students, still up. Those final numbers are still in the works, and wounded around 20 others at Umpqua Community College. The gunman himself later died in a shootout with police. Tragically, this type of news has become fairly common in the U.S., with President Obama in a speech yesterday saying the public has become numb to these shootings, and that he says are now routine. Beverly Kingston, director of CU's Center for the Study and Prevention of Violence, can relate to the president's frustration watching this violent American routine repeat itself over and over again. Beverly is here in the studio this morning to discuss some of the less discussed means of addressing this issue. Beverly, thank you so much for joining us in the studio.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, as someone who studies the prevention of violence, can you tell us about what patterns you're seeing here?
Yeah, we see these kinds of school shootings as really the tip of what you can kind of call the violence iceberg. And they're very, right at the top. So what's underneath these, although they've been occurring more and more, is a whole trends and patterns of problem behaviors. And so what we see about 20-25% of our kids in schools are being bullied. We see untreated mental health problems. There's been a huge movement around identifying trauma from the past that then is affecting people's current realities. And so there's these statistical patterns of lots of hurting people in our culture. But underneath that, what we can identify are risk and protective factors that actually predict these problem behaviors. They're predictive, just like, you could have the risk and protective factors for cancer or heart disease. So it's very similar. So those are the underlying patterns, and we seek to address those root causes of this kind of violence.
And we'll talk a little bit more here in a bit about some of those systemic, big picture elements to culture that facilitate this behavior. I was wondering if you can tell us a little bit about how noticing these patterns, what successes you've seen, what programs mm-hmm. you've seen that have used that seem to start to address that tip of the iceberg kind of issue, particularly here in Colorado.
Yeah. So sadly, I mean, it's hard to talk about this right now, just right after, but yet we need to, because we know so much about what works and we can put those things into practice. And so, like I was saying, sadly, Colorado has experienced this firsthand multiple times. And some of the most tragic victims or people who are right in the front lines are my dear friends. And I'm sad because we're all hurting today. But in Colorado, we have done some things that are proven to work. And thankfully, we have those tools. So one of the things that we know, there was a Secret Service report that's you can find online. We'll put that on your website, Hannah, after this. And what we know is that in these kinds of shootings, there's lots of red flags and warning signs. So I don't know the particulars about this situation, but I can talk about many that have been studied in the past. And so what we know is that about 4 out of 5 of these shooters have told someone about what they're going to do. And oftentimes they've told more than one person. We also know that there's a lot of warning signs and red flags. So sometimes someone's seen something, or they feel very uncomfortable, like they just get the hairs on the back of their neck start to rise. And so they know something awful is going to go on. We have a lot of intuition around that too. And so in Colorado, we've actually put a system into place to collect that kind of information anonymously. And that program is called Safe to Tell. And it's an anonymous bystander reporting system that operates out of the Colorado Attorney General's office. And it came out of the Columbine recommendations. Colorado is currently the only state that has Safe to Tell and this anonymous reporting system. And it is being used since it started in 2004, there's been about 15,000 reports, tips that are all followed up. And there's a 24/7 live person to take these calls, or we have safe to tell text, or you could report on through the website. So it's a two-way dialogue, and it's a way to report anything that just doesn't seem right that could affect the safety of our communities and our kids and our families. And so it's prevented lots of violence, suicide, school shootings.
And so why is this program, it's only in Colorado, you're saying?
Yes. Yeah,
so what are the barriers to expanding such a successful program elsewhere? And I'm sure there's more that can be done within Colorado as well, but why is such a successful program stopped at Colorado's borders, do you think?
Well, you know, one is that there's a lack of funding. There's a lack of resources. We have a national board for Safe to Tell that is looking at a national expansion of this model. The state of Nevada has just passed legislation to support Safe to Tell. So they've actually put it into their legislation and have funding at the state level to support it. That's the first state that is actually going to be replicating Safe to Tell in the Safe to Tell model. There's lots of other systems. Some of them are for-profit. Some of them are not anonymous. And in Safe to Tell, that's a critical element of that because we have law. It's protected by law that your report will not be played on the news. It will be protected. And that's, people need to know that when they're unsure about reporting. And so we want to make sure that this model and the fidelity to this model is what is replicated and not kind of just a fly-by-night. You know, other things that happen in other places are tip lines or a box at the school to report, to, you know, put things in to report problem behavior, but those aren't 24/7. Safe to Tell also has law enforcement involvement so that every tip is followed up. So if it is something that's very dangerous, it will immediately go to the proper law enforcement channels. And there's also teams at schools and within communities that will follow up on these tips.
And we'll, on our website, as we said, we're going to list some of the other programs. Real quickly, can you list off some of those programs? And then we'll put more description of that on our website. And then in closing, can you also just kind of wrap this up here by explaining to us a little bit more about some of those cultural and policy systems mm-hmm. that we have here in this country that you think might be allowing this type of violence to continue and, in fact, mm-hmm. increase in prevalence?
Yeah, absolutely. So my biggest message is that we do know so much about what works to prevent youth violence, to prevent these kinds of things. This guy was older, but I guarantee that this didn't start overnight. These things are patterns of behavior. And so we have proven, tested, and effective programs. Our center has it's like a consumer report for social programs for positive youth development and to prevent violence called Blueprints for Healthy Youth Development. These are tested and effective programs. We know that if we put these programs truly into place, we could reduce youth violence and other problem behaviors by about 30%, but we aren't putting those into place. Only about 5% of those who need these programs are gaining access.
And access, it sounds like, is part of the issue in general. We talked a little bit earlier about mental health being the stigma associated with that. And, mm-hmm. and, you know, if you look at overall the average insurance policy, right, it's not necessarily seeing encouragement to seek mental health help, you know, for early signs of trouble, but more so in crisis situations. Is that something that you think also plays into this as more of a systemic issue?
Absolutely. We could be doing a much better job applying a public health approach to violence prevention. And with that, that would mean, yes, we have things in place like Safe to Tell and treatments for those that are at that top, the tip of the iceberg, but that we also have systems to prevent this. Just like you go to the dentist, you know, to get your teeth cleaned or you change your oil, we could be promoting social emotional learning in the schools, and we can start as early as before kids are born. And so we need to build that infrastructure. We call it a prevention infrastructure in our nation, and we do not have that yet.
And once more, can you tell us, for more information, I know we are going to list some things on our website. Are there other resources or other groups that you would advise that our listeners get in touch with if this is something that they want to find out more about or get involved with? And again, we will list on our website as well.
Yeah, if you really want to dive deep, I would recommend looking at an Institute of Medicine report from 2009 that's on preventing behavioral and mental health disorders. There's also a National Coalition for Prevention Science. So I think it's looking at some of these prevention science resources. There's a whole field that's been emerging over the last 30 years around prevention science. And we just haven't done a great job of getting the word out and linking it to these violent incidents. If we do a better job with prevention science, these things will be reduced.
And that was Beverly Kingston, director of CU's Center for the Study and Prevention of Violence, talking to us about some of the less discussed means of addressing the prevalence of these acts of violence, like school shootings, in the U.S. Beverly, thank you so much for joining me this morning.